Welcome to Design Speaks, the podcast that empowers you to stay inspired, be creative on demand, and find your visual voice. I'm your host, Brandy C. Joining me today is Lauren from For the Creatives. This is part two of our conversation all about what we wish we knew when we started our design business. So stay tuned for that coming up later in the show. We worship the stars and I blow your mind while you kiss my scars and we know. So uncommon inspiration for me this week slash lately is actually children's book illustrations and young adult illustrations, specifically for book covers. My kids are both big readers, as am I, but I never really got into the young adult genre myself, and a lot of the children's books that I read growing up were more classic books. Hence my love for them. But there are so many incredible children's books and young adult books, preteen, teen books out there. And the kids have really been into a lot of those lately. And I've been really looking at a lot of the book covers, specifically The Land of Stories by Chris Colfer, The Magical Misfits. And my daughter really loves these books by Brandon Mole and another set of books called Keeper of the Lost Cities. I will link to those in the show notes. But something about having to choose a specific scene to portray or how to kind of show what the book is about on the cover where characters are involved is really intriguing to me. I feel like there's different challenges that come from designing a book cover for something like George Orwell's 1984 or something like The Land of Stories or Lemony Snicket, things like that that have these characters that people are really absorbed in. My daughter really wants to figure out what these people would look like in real life. And I think that it's just been really inspiring to me to try and understand what goes into all of that. So that's something that I've been really intrigued by and inspired by. There aren't any specific styles as far as those illustrations go. Like when I'm looking for children's books, like picture books, I'm definitely drawn to something in particular, some sketchy, more like hand-drawn looks. But for these books that my kids have been into, it's a really interesting thing to kind of look at and be inspired by how they paint, illustrate these beloved characters. It was the night before Christmas, it was love at first sight. The carolers sang as they danced through the night. She was a small town girl, he was a traveling guy. He never caught her name before they said their goodbyes. A couple years later, he was out on the road, having Christmas dinner in a diner alone. When he saw a young waitress with a gleam in her eye, her favorite day of the year, she showed her spirits were high. She said, "Sir, can you share a little hearty cheer?" My song this week, as Christmas is so near, is called His Favorite Christmas Story by a group named Capitol Lights. It came out a while ago, 2008, which is the year my daughter was born, so 13 years ago, and that is absolutely crazy. But it's definitely in my top five Christmas songs ever. And I think it's because it is so wrapped around story. It's not simply singing about, you know, just general observations about jingling bells or white Christmas or snowing. There's a story that has a clear beginning and a clear end. And basically, it's a story about a man who met a girl while he was traveling. They danced at Christmas time, the night before Christmas, they danced together. He never knew her name, but he goes through life every year telling the kids in his town all about this girl that he met. I'm not going to ruin the surprise of how it ends, but it is just a spectacular song. It's super catchy. It's really sweet, and I hope that you guys enjoy it. You can find this song and all the songs that I feature on Design Speaks Podcast on our playlist, Music from Design Speaks Podcast, over on Spotify. Something else in regards to pricing, I put pricing is hard. I put that as one of my points that I didn't think was going to be a thing. I just thought I'll just charge a thing and people will pay a thing and we'll trade money for the thing and it'll be fine.
Oh, man. Yes. Pricing was probably the biggest, the most nerve-wracking part of my first client. I remember when I got a referral from like a long-term family friend who'd known me since I was four, and she referred me to a friend of hers. And I remember the heart beating, the freak out, the sweating when they asked me how much am I going to charge. And I had no idea. I didn't know if I should do hourly. I didn't know if I should do per project. They kind of wanted to have me on a retainer. So I ended up going hourly, and I think I stayed on the internet for hours, like days researching what's an hourly rate, what do you do. And I came to the conclusion of doing, I think based on what my own experience, which was like about 7 years at that point, I said it was $50 an hour, and then the client was like trying to get it down, and oh man, it was just the worst thing. And that's why I'm sure you have your own experience on this and so many stories to tell. But that's why I am such an advocate for not doing hourly pricing unless you are at the end of a contract, there's scope creep, and you need to do hourly to put them in place, the client, so that as many revisions they keep going, they're going to get charged hourly. So that's the only time. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm totally with you with that. What I started doing, and something I still do because it is really important to make them understand that you are not a vending machine, is anytime somebody asks me, well, I'm looking, let's not even go logo because that's the low-hanging fruit, right? Everybody wants a logo. But somebody wants a banner designed for a concert or something, and they say, hey, I have this show coming up. I was wondering how much you would charge me to just design a promo banner. And no matter what the project is, I will always say, you know what? I'd love to give you a price for that. And that sounds like a really exciting project. I'm going to send you a form over that you can look over before we have a phone call, and we can go over those questions together, talk about exactly what it is you need, talk about when you need it by, some deadlines, like what you're looking to do with this whole thing, get your all the stuff that's going to go into this project, because I can't give you a real price without really understanding what our goals are and what you need from me. And that does a couple of things, right? It shows them you are not a vending machine. I am not just a tool that it uses a program that you would do yourself if you could do it. And it also shows your level of professionalism in that, oh, this is going to be custom to me. This is going to be a conversation. And you're starting that relationship off right, as opposed to, well, $500. Okay, cool. What does that get me? And then it turns into a whole other sort of conversation. So yes, absolutely. I think that not doing hourly, I haven't done hourly in ages. I think that's a good base to start figuring out what your price will be. Like in the end, if you go, I'm going to start with what would I be charging hourly, add on who is this client, right? What is the value to them long term? If I'm working with PepsiCo, is going to be a completely different kind of value monetization versus if I'm working for Joe Pizza's place down the street. And so you start with one thing, you add that value, you add the longevity, and then you can start to figure out what that final price is going to be. And then if they go over and above, right, if you say we get, oh, three revisions on this thing and then they want four, then you start charging the hourly, and make sure the hourly makes them cringe a little bit. Like, because if they go, oh, cool, $25 an hour extra on top, yeah, that's fine. I could easily do like three or four more hours. Don't do that. Like if the hourly rate on top of whatever you're charging does not make them go, ooh, I don't want to have to pay for another hour, you're probably not charging enough. That's a whole sidebar. But
yeah, that's a good point. I like that. Cringeworthy hourly rates. And I think that it's interesting because What you're talking about with doing the value-based pricing, a lot of my design business, I had actually charged package-based. And I was doing a lot of package-based pricing because the specific niche that I had chosen, and niching is a whole other subject that is on my list. And I did the research into competitors. I looked at what the general niche expected, and they like to see prices up front. So now what that does, though, is I was attracting newer type of specific people in that niche, people who were not really serious. And I would gradually raise my package prices, and I got to a point that I was happy with. But then I realized that I could actually be really, really doing an even more, charging more, really giving better service and doing an even better job if I could take it and really use that value-based pricing. And I think that the package-based pricing really helped me to learn a lot about what the timeframes were. It really got me, you know, it's kind of like what I did at the beginning with hourly. It got me accustomed to, is that worth it? Is that actually valuable? Should I be charging more? And I got really good at estimating my own timing on projects. But what I think is so, so important is when you, if you want to be working with larger projects and you want to be attracting the right type of people, you can have on your contact form something where you says what budget you're willing to charge. And maybe have a drop down like I do now. And I get to know if somebody is not willing to pay a minimum level of engagement of $1,000, and I don't like to work with them because I know the amount of time taking on a new client is. So I know I'm kind of jumping all over the place, but
You're not. We're talking about pricing. Yeah.
Yes.
I think that pricing is something that's really hard for people. They're like, even now, even today, as my skill level increases, as my niche changes, as I, you know, learn how to do new things. So I started speaking a few years ago and figuring out, well, now this is a whole new territory. How do I price my speaking gigs? How do I charge for doing workshops compared to doing speaking gigs? Like, is it travel plus honorarium? Is it just travel and food? Like, there's just like so many things with pricing. So just understanding in the beginning, it is hard for everybody. And you should always try to charge more than you think you should. That's probably like the baseline, I would say, because I don't think that anyone charges in the beginning what they are actually worth. And that's really hard to understand, that the less you charge, the less you are going to be seen as a professional.
Yes, exactly. And it's kind of like, go step outside the comfort zone. And one bit of actionable information to tell you, to your audience about that, which I feel is just a good starting point, is really understanding your own business expenses and your own personal expenses. And realize when you leave a corporate job, if your spouse doesn't have health insurance covered, you're going to have to pay for health insurance too. So there's a lot of different things that you have to be thinking with, not to mention the Adobe subscriptions or whatever software you use, your computer, electricity, even if you're working in your house. There's so many different points that you are probably not thinking with if you are working in house, and that needs to be included as your very minimum baseline, not even taking into account taxes and all the different expenses. So you have to charge enough, and you have to know that inside and out.
Yeah, and not just price to hopefully get as many people to say yes as possible. If you're charging as much as you should, you won't need as many people. That's the other thing. It's like, if I'm charging as much as I should be, and full transparency, sometimes I'll charge between $7,500 and $10,000 just for the strategy, like zero design work, zero. And so understanding that if I do that, if I hope to make X amount of dollars a year, I don't have to do 10 million clients this year to achieve that goal. I have to be strategic about how I'm getting the people that are going to be okay with and need the kind of strategy and design, hopefully, that I can provide them for that amount. And then it's a lot less stressful because you're not trying to get, oh, this week I need to do 10 design jobs, because who can do that? Nobody can do that.
No. And that actually is the next thing on my list is how not to burn out. And it's exactly what you're saying, because when I was charging less, I was working nights, I was working weekends, I had my baby on me, I was working. And yeah, there's going to be that time where you have to put a lot of time into building your business and getting yourself out there and getting clients, which is a whole nother item on my list. But the burnout factor, you're going to burn out if you're just have to do a million projects just to get by. So I definitely agree. And I love that you're charging that much and getting that worth. I actually had a student who had been charging, I think it was a few $100 for her brand identity. And she then, I helped her, got her through. She actually went through my program, and she was actually able to once she saw her value and she felt more confident and was positioning herself correctly, able to charge $5,000. And the client said, yes, no question. So it is possible. You just have to set yourself up correctly.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, speaking of burnout, one of the things that I have on my list that's very closely related is that I wish I had known that balance is not a thing. There is no, especially for work at home moms like us, right? I think in the beginning, especially because I only had one child at the time when I first started in 2012, she was 4. And she was still she was going full time to daycare pre-K. I guess it wasn't daycare, pre-K. And I thought, well, this isn't so bad. Like, I can keep a balance here. And then when I had my son in 2013, all of a sudden, I was getting really frustrated with myself and with everybody around me that I couldn't balance, quote unquote, like my family time and my work obligations and trying to blog and do all the other things I was starting to do in building this whole education stuff that I do. I didn't realize probably until, I want to say probably 2018, when my lung collapsed and I had a whole bunch of crazy medical stuff, that balance is not a thing. It's a teeter-totter It's not like a teeter-totter where you're trying to like balance. It is a tug of war. Like, what you're either giving or you're taking from something else. There's no way that I can balance how much time I'm spending on my business and the time that I'm spending time with my family. If I'm not spending time on my business is not getting something, but my family is. So I'm taking away from my business to give to my family and vice versa. Once I realized that that was a thing and I was okay with it, I am okay with the fact that yesterday I barely touched my business because it's a full homeschool day. And could I be working on my business while I am homeschooling my son? Yeah, but that's taking away from him something that he needs from me. And this morning, today is a recording day for me. Today is a business day for me. My husband does homeschool with our kiddo all day because it's his day off. So today I am taking me away from that, from my family, to put it into my business. And I wish that I would have known, and I wouldn't have been so hard on myself for not being able to give like 50-50. It's just not a thing. You're either giving 100 and 100 or you're not giving at all. There's no such thing as being able to split yourself in half.
Yeah, I love that, Brandy. That's beautiful. And it's so true. I had this when I was in Washington, when we were living there, I would leave my phone upstairs. Like, I would take it, I would say this, you know, I'm done with my work time. My phone stays here and I go be with my kids. Like, it's time and I'm not going to mix them because I'm going to feel super stressed. I'm going to have attention on two things. And it's just, yeah, it's you have to set your own boundaries and really keep yourself true to that and true to why you're even doing your business. What is the reason, the personal reason, obviously to make an impact and to help your clients and fulfill your creative dreams and that's all valid, but what's the deeper personal reason? You got to be there for that, and that's super important to me. And I love that you're able to dedicate whole days to that. That's really, really nice.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, speaking of why, and I've talked about this on my Instagram before, but I don't think I talk about it enough in general, is a huge reason that I do what I do is that I don't believe that being a mom has to be anyone's full identity. I think that for some women, that's what they want and that's what they enjoy. And that's great. For me and for my personality, once my kids are out of the house, I am no longer going to be a work at home anything. I will be back out in the workforce, I think, because that's what I foresee being fulfilling to me. And so what I want my daughter specifically, but also my son, it's really valuable to me that they see that a woman can be a good wife, a good mom, and be amazing at her job and like actually see it happen. They hear me record podcast episodes. They see me writing for blogs. They see me editing videos and, you know, designing and coaching people and speaking and doing workshops and all of the things that I do. They get to see that I can do that and also be a good mom, and that they don't have to choose between being a parent or being passionate about something that, like in my case, God has called me to do. I believe that he's called me to be a good mom and be awesome at what I do for a living. Like, I've been given these skills for a reason. And I think it's really important that our kids see that we can do anything. There's, you know, we have to put ourselves in the box that we want people to see us in, not let other people put us in that box. So there's my little rant.
Oh, that is a beautiful rant. Thank you for that. Oh, 1,000%. And yes, I love, you know, the whole world of entrepreneurship and women entrepreneurship and women being or mompreneurs. I know there's all these different fun terms for it. I think it's exciting, and it's so, I think it sets a really good example to also them understanding business and understanding the exchange point, because while I love my parents very much, I never understood money. They never taught me about money. It was always just something that they said we didn't have enough of, even though my dad made a very good salary. So it was always this concept that, no, we don't have enough money. You can't get this. You can't get this. The framework that my husband and I get into with our kids now is, okay, so you want this Lego set, this Millennium Falcon Lego set? Okay, well, let's figure out how you can do it. Here's the amount of days you need to work at this amount. And it gets, they see where we work. We're there to actually help them have a good living, go to a good school. And so it gets them in a different mindset that money is not something that's non-existent. It's something that can be created, and your goals can be achieved through hard work. So
for sure.
Totally.
That's really good. The last point that I have that I probably buried the lead here is like concept for me in design work. I think that I always worked from a point of developing a good design concept, but I think that I underestimated the power of concept, and that concept is as important or more important than the craft itself. And there are a lot of businessy things, I think, that we've talked about in, you know, owning your own design business. Most of this has been about the business end that most people don't understand. But something that I think that it's important for people to know is your concepting, your ability to come up with ideas is what people are paying you for. All the other stuff is really hard. It's really challenging. The loneliness, the strategy, the branding for yourself and marketing and all of those things. But if you can't come up with good ideas, you're not going to get any work. And so understanding how to come up with good concepts, great concepts that are not only going to make people want to hire you, but that are going to be expressive of your visual voice, that are showing the kind of inspiration that you know how to take in and use, and crafting that into a meaningful and purposeful design, I think is very, very underestimated when people, they think, okay, I have this software, I have a level, even if you've been in the business for 10 years, I have a level of being able to come up with ideas. Like, I can go find my inspiration on Dribbble or Pinterest, and I have a process of, you know, being able to make a good mood board and just come up with something, not realizing that that is literally what everybody else does. And so understanding that your concepts and your ability to come up with something that is a reflection of you uniquely is the primary way you are going to get the kind of work that not only makes you money, but is super fulfilling to you.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think that something I want to add to it is having to do with something I stress a lot on my channel. So I didn't want to get too much into it in this interview, but the power of choosing an exact target audience and actually specializing mm-hmm. and understanding them and that business and really immersing yourself in that world will help you to be able to then go and actually create better concepts and understand what their goal is even better and being able to then create products that get really good case studies and really help them to do some incredible things in their own business, which is then going to just attract more of what you love to work on. So I think that kind of goes hand in hand with really being able to create amazing products.
Yeah. And for me, the audience plays into two areas. It is part of your strategy as a personal brand. So that's understanding all of the things and creating that persona, that ideal person of who they are for who you want to work with. But then also being able to do that using the brief and the strategy for your clients to help them understand who their audience is also. Because most of the time when someone's hiring you, they are not hiring you for themselves. They are hiring you to design something, but you're not designing for them. You're designing for their audience. And seeing the difference there and being able to put your foot down and go, I don't, you know, based on what you've told me, I don't believe that that's going to appeal to your target audience. It doesn't matter if the ones that are paying you don't like it sometimes, because they need to understand that, you know, maybe you are a 65-year-old Hispanic male, but your company appeals to, you know, maybe you have a toy company and you're trying to appeal to like 10 to 13-year-old boys. What you like does not matter in that instance. You are designing for their audience. And so really understanding audiences in general and realizing how to make that work for yourself as a business owner and for your clients is really, really, really important. So yeah, you said you've talked a lot about that on your channel. So everyone can go check some of those out. And we've talked a lot about it on this podcast as well.
Yeah, I think that just one example of that and is I was working in a corporate job and I remember I was designing book cover and this book cover, I was super excited about the design of it. I went and surveyed it. I actually went in front of Barnes & Noble. I went and talked to book readers who were in that specific genre and I got exact feedback. It was super clear. It was exactly what they said. I went and tweaked it so that it would fit them. I remember submitting it to, you know, the heads of the company who had to approve it, and they didn't personally like it. So even though the evidence all showed that this was what the surveys, I had done hundreds of them, that's what showed. That's what was going to appeal to that audience, but the right. internal team didn't like it. And that goes for any client anywhere. It has to mm-hmm. be for that real audience, not for just personal taste.
Absolutely. And where strategy, we come all the way back to the beginning of this and like the strategy thing comes in is when you can really, you know, obviously you're sometimes you may get really stubborn clients, bosses, whatever, but ultimately I can't remember the last time I really had someone go, no, do it this way anyway, when I had a solid reason backed up by strategy for doing whatever it was I was doing. In your case, changing up the design of that book cover to appeal to the right target audience. Most of them really do want to trust you. Most clients really do want to trust you. So the last point that I have is that there are no clients from hell. If you have a client from hell, it's because you took on a client that you shouldn't have. And that's on you. I know that's a hot take, but most people that have really bad clients, it's because they weren't vetted properly in the beginning. They weren't. And if you have a good gatekeeping process, like we talked about earlier, you're not going to get a client from hell because they're going to understand how you work and they're going to value what you do.
Yes. Love that. I've learned that the hard way. I've blamed a million clients. I've owned up to a million other ones. And man, it always does come back to own personal responsibility, because as a business owner, you can't be blaming other people. You can't be blaming the client. It's just, you're not going to succeed that way.
Yeah. So that's my last thing. I think that I didn't realize till way too late that I wish I had known sooner was like, oh, there's no such thing as bad clients. Oh, okay, this is on me. But that's also, you could either take it as like kind of discouraging or go, oh, this is on me, which means I can change it and I don't have to have these kinds of clients anymore. And there's going to be some people that seem fine in the beginning that sometimes turn out to not be great. But that is much fewer and further between when you have a good onboarding process. So any last points before we wrap up today?
Well, I think it's really just about, you are a business owner when you're starting a business. And while a lot of times I refer to freelance design, that's just because I'm in my YouTube channel, you know, that's the keyword that people search for when they're starting is freelance design.
Right.
But you're a business owner when you want to go and start your own business. And that means that you are taking on a whole new role, a whole new adventure. And you have to be in the right mindset and read books about business, read books about systems. Reading books has been the best thing that has gotten me to the next level in my business. And I can't understate that enough, that just be seeking knowledge, always be looking for a new way to improve. And you will, if you persist, you can make your business succeed. So many people have, Brandy has, I have, so can you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think even still, sometimes it sounds a little, I don't know what the word is, like self-congratulatory when I introduce myself and say I own my own design business. I think, am I lying? Because like, I don't have a whole bunch of employees. It's me. And I mean, I hire out to other designers, and like, I start questioning my motives for saying it. And it's like, no, you own a design business.
Yeah, like, you
this
do.
This is legitimately what you do. And so practice saying it out loud. Practice telling people, I own my own design business. I own my own design business, because it's not always easy to say, especially in the beginning. You're just like, I do design. I do graphic design. Do you need something?
Yes.
Crickets. No, I don't. I don't understand what you do. So just trying to be confident in that. And so... thank you so much, Lauren, for joining me. I think that we could easily have a full episode on like every single one of these topics. And that's the good and the bad of these conversations, is sometimes I just want to talk forever. But alas, this is already two episodes. So I know that all of these topics are going to be helpful to people. And it was a good exercise in self-awareness for me to be able to look back at some of the things that I wish I would have known. And I hadn't really done this as a podcast episode. So thanks for being the creative biz gal and really bringing this for us to chat about.
Yeah. I've loved talking to you about this. It's so much fun. I loved hearing about your stories, and you've made some really awesome points too. So always fun to talk to you, Brandy.
Well, I hope I can get back on your show soon too, and maybe we can do this again in the future. So I hope you have a great day. Thanks, Lauren.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Brandy. You too.
All right, lovelies, that's our episode for today. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you again, Lauren, for being here as a really fun guest. Please be sure to leave us a review over on iTunes, and you can always send a note to us at designspeakspodcast.com. Design Speaks is produced by Kenneth Niffin and Dakota Cook. You can find show notes and all past episodes at designspeakspodcast.com, or even more content at brandyc.com. Shout out to Colin from Vespertine for our incredible theme music. Design Speaks podcast is produced by Brandy C. Design Co. and is recorded in the shadow of the Watermelon Pink Sandia Mountains near Albuquerque, New Mexico. As always, I'm Brandy C., reminding you that you can take control of your creativity. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Till next time.